Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of our Digital Dialogue series. In this series, we've been talking with some amazing thinkers and farmers, organizers and activists, and we've been talking about land, our relationship to land, as well as issues around food sovereignty, land rematriation, land back, and relational accountability. So today, Danielle Boissonneau and I talk with Beezy Gray. Beezy is an Anishinaabe water protector and land defender from Omgenong First Nation. Beezy has been an active voice in the movement against environmental racism and in support of decolonization from a really young age. Along with their ongoing activism, Beezy has also been doing land-based work and learning Ojibwe in their own effort to revitalize the language. Beezy's work and activism are varied and pull from their experiences as a Two-Spirit youth. We talk today with Beezy about environmental racism, colonial extraction, land back, and Indigenous land-based work and resistance. Thanks for tuning in today, and we really hope you enjoy this conversation.
Cool. Thank you, Sarah. My name is Danielle Boissonneau. I'm Anishinaabe Kwe from Garden River, Ontario, but I've been living in Hamilton the past 20 years of my life and became a part of the Rare Collective because I have a strong feeling of responsibility in terms of doing what I can where I am. And sometimes being in an urban environment means doing work that aligns with research. And I think that this research is really cool, and I'm happy to be a part of this collective. And I'm super happy to be talking to Beezy today. Longtime friend, and really excited to get into the convo with you. So I guess we'll hop right into it. Beezy, I wonder, what is your name and your nation and your clan and your ancestry? And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about yourself within that context.
Ani Bojo, Beezy Gray Indigenous, Makoan Dodam, Omchong Donjaba, Anishinaabe Ndau, Oneida Ndau, Lenape Ndau, Nish Menadok Ndau. Hi, hello. I always do my introduction in Anishinaabe Moin first, because that is what an elder taught me from my community, is to always introduce yourself in your language first and then translate it for people. And usually when I do that, it scares people because then they're like listening to the language. They're like, oh crap, is this kid always going to speak in the language now? And then I'm like, nope, I will translate it. So my name is Beezy, and it doesn't mean anything. People usually ask me like, oh, what does Beezy mean? There's nothing special. I am a Beezy. I come from Omgenong First Nation. I've been told I'm Bear Clan by my grandma. I am like, I joke that I'm a tri-nation from down there because my family went to the different reserves and mixed and made me. So I'm Anishinaabe, Lenape, and Oneida. So those are my different nations, and those are the different nations that are like represented in like Southern Ontario. And I feel like that's who I hold like my accountability and responsibility to, is to like that territory, as well as like the territories that spanned within my nationhood of like Oneida covers like a really cool and like diverse area. Anishinaabe people cover like a really big area, and like historically where my community comes from spans like Michigan, even like of like where even we were found as a people, like for Omgenong, as well as Lenape go all the way out to like New Jersey and like where the islands are of like New York City. I'm like, those places are really cool, and that's like part of like my lineage. But those are who I feel like the most accountable and responsible to. The most I feel is like my grandparents and like the older people above me. Like they always ask what I'm doing, and like really curious as to like what I get into or what kind of trouble I get into, as well as seven generations before and seven generations ahead is like who I say like I'm accountable to, of like everything that like I really embed myself with, like of like my interests and like work is usually for future generations and thinking of those seven generations that came before me.
Thanks, BZ. So I'm hoping you can share a little bit about your relationship to land and how that's changed over time, a little bit about maybe where you come from and how your relationship to land has evolved over time. We know, and maybe some listeners might know about some of your work with Anjanong Solidarity against, you know, Chemical Valley and stuff like that. But I also know about all the wonderful work that you're doing now. And so if you can tell us a little bit about how that's evolved and to what extent, if any, that that has to do with the concept of rematriation.
I feel like I've always had like a really strong affinity to like water. Like water has been one of my favorite things ever. Like it was my favorite thing when I was born. And where my reserve is, we have the St. Clair River. That's like a really big connection pathway for the Great Lakes. Like it connects St. Clair Lake to like Huron and like Erie, and it connects like those bigger, really massive, amazing waterways to like all the way up to the St. Lawrence. So I always thought that was like a cool area of like the water, and the water so blue down there. Like it's always like a really sparkly blue, which I thought was always so pretty. And then my connection to land, growing up, I basically would like spend the morning like inside watching cartoons, but then by early afternoon I would be outside, like always like running around. I knew behind my house really, really well. And I knew the back pathways to get to the different parts of the reserve. And I always felt really comfortable with like just traveling on my own, like at a very young age, to go all around the reserve. And one thing that I liked about reserve life was that people would just know, like they would ask you, like if they just saw a random res kid, they'd be like, oh, who's your grandpa? Who's your grandma? And then you'd say them and then they'd be like, oh, I know who you are. And they would instantly like just be like, oh yeah, I know you. And then like it just felt safe. So like I could like do pretty much anything, get up to anything. I was pretty like reckless as a kid. I'd climb like the tallest trees in the community, like in the backwoods, and no one would know. And then like I would climb back down and get home before dinner. And like that's pretty unsafe when you think about it now. Like for your kid just to be off like in the tallest tree and then like hopefully they made it back home. And that was always something, like my grandma has old journals of she like has like these prayer journals, and she would write down her prayers as she was saying them. And she did it every single day. And she used to babysit me a lot. Like she was one of the people who raised me. And one of her books, like a lot of her like journals would be like, okay, and now I got to go find BZ. And then she would like write again in her journal, and like an hour later in the afternoon, she'd be like, I found BZ. They were up in the tree in the yard. And then she'd be like, I had to like convince them to come down, because like I knew I had power when I climbed a tree. Cause like my grandma would be like, okay, you got to come in for nap time. And I would negotiate with her to do something like else to get me to climb down. And so like, I could get away with a lot if I was like already up in the tree and like she had to convince me to come down. So I've always had like that really strong connection to like just being like outside and doing whatever. Like I would do so much outside, like anything I wanted to do inside, I would usually do it outside. But the thing that was like interesting to me was that I grew up in Canada's Chemical Valley, which holds like 40% of Canada's like petrochemical industry, and it makes like oil stuff for planes. All of its byproducts are made into things like plastic, rubbers, like that go in. GC Food bubblegum is what I always reference to, is the same rubber that goes into our tires. And like that's made in Chemical Valley. That was like made in like is still made in like our backyard. And they make like a bunch of other stuff, like they make chemicals and like cleaning products. But so many byproducts come from that petrochemical industry. But we've always felt like that impact of pollution, because it was like refineries run every single day of the year, all night, all day. And like, we were always impacted by like those spills and stuff. So that was always like really scary, where like being out in the community or in and around, and then all of a sudden Monday, every 12:30, there would be a siren going off, or there would be an air spill, and all of a sudden you'd get like shortness of breath or like a headache or something, and feeling like those impacts like of being on the land. And then because growing up on the reserve, like, and like in the time that I did, I grew up like in the 90s, late 2000s on the reserve, early 2000s. on the reserve, and like feeling those like impacts of like residential schools are being talked about as like young kids. Like my grandma would tell me about my grandpa, who like she'd say went away to school, and then like she told me like those like impacts of like she knew the language really, really, really well. And she would speak to it with her sister, with me, but we would almost like do it in secret. Like she would take me to her sister's house and they would speak in the language together, and they would have like everyday conversations in the language. And I would just be hanging out there, like listening to it. But she said that her husband didn't like my grandpa would never, like he didn't feel comfortable with that kind of stuff anymore because of residential schools, she'd say, because of those schools. So growing up like in that kind of time, like I was very interested in like, and I still am really interested in like language and learning back like what we did, because I was always so curious. Just like I was curious about the refineries. I was like, what is like culture? What is tradition? Like, what did we used to do? Like, how did we stay occupied like with our time? And like, how did we create things? Was always like a really big thought on my mind, because from what I grew up with, I would see like Chemical Valley like pumping out like all these like plastics and all these things, and how time was being used now for like making like oil and cars. But it always made me interested in like our ways too, because like I got really interested in like what plants used to be here, like what plants are here, like what can I use. But that's when I was growing up, I learned about like we had sometimes like restrictions on like what years we could grow gardens, even because of the pollution, where like they would be like, this year is a good year to grow gardens, this year isn't a good year because of like the air pollution. And I was also taught like for harvesting, like I knew like cedar grew in our community, but I was always taught to like go outside the community to even collect cedar or those kinds of things. They're like, this is something you can harvest, but you can't do it here. Like go somewhere where it's further from Chemical Valley, and then like then that's where you can go collect. And those things are like I was so like honored and like happy to like learn those things. But like it was more like outreach kind of thing, and that community connection that like I would go to like Walpole or Kettle and Stony Point, to like neighboring reserves and find those like connections and make connections with land that was like a little bit like it was like more like less polluted than mine, but like healthier than mine, and making those connections in community of like harvesting in their community, as well as learning. Like I learned a lot of land teachings from my Lenape family in Moraviantown. Sometimes we call it Bucktown. A lot of us call it Bucktown, but I learned a lot in Bucktown, and they taught me like dip net fishing. I went to like different types of like ceremonies there, and like really learned like that I loved fishing, and like I even learned archery there. But I learned a lot of like land-based stuff there, and I learned that I could practice that stuff there. And that was something I was really grateful, but like I didn't feel like I had that like urge to do it in my community, because we were seeing like deers like have cancer and stuff like that, where like they were getting sick just like the people. And like that was like really hard, because it was like sometimes you would catch a fish or get a deer, you'd hear community members, and then they'd be like, oh, but there was a tumor, so we couldn't harvest it. and it would like have to get like, it would have to get like taken up by like another, like other animals and stuff, like the people would need it. But things like that were like really, really difficult of like being, growing up and like trying to learn back like language and culture. Even when I think of like language, it was like, it still is like where I'm like, the ways I would describe the land in Anishinaabemowin are different than the way my grandma would growing up. Like those things are different. And like talking about Chemical Valley is like really, really hard in the language. And then also, like we just came up with words to talk about like climate change and all that kind of stuff. Like just like this year, I saw an article of coming out of how we even like pronounce carbon in Anishinaabemowin, which I think is really cool. And like our language is always evolving, and it's always like based on like our lands that it evolves. Like the language is very much based on the land. I would say that's my relationship to land, is like those stories, or those connections are like, I come from a place of pollution, but I still like really connected with my culture and language, but it has an impact of like where I come from, of like learning like what pollution does to a community over like over 100 years of being polluted on, and like feeling those disruptions and connections to land, where like when I was growing up, I knew not to touch Telford Creek. Like it's not somewhere you swim, it's not somewhere you touch. And that's because they did a bunch of illegal dumpings in the 80s. And like feeling those impacts of like shortness of breath all of a sudden, because they're releasing some kind of chemical that doesn't make you breathe properly. And like experiencing that, like when you're feeling your best and you're on the land and out for a walk, or like just like having time spent with plants, and then feeling the impact of industrial plants. yeah, but I felt like that my healing of like, because I've been doing speaking about like Chemical Valley since I was in grade 8. Like I started talking about it as a two-spirit youth, talking about like those impacts of growing up where I did, and how pollution really impacts the community, and how pipelines impact a community because we have so many pipelines in my area. But that my healing came through like working with the lands. Like sugar bushing is healing, hide tanning is healing, seed saving is healing. All those things like make me feel like really good and connected to land, and also give me like a break from technology. Like I don't need my computer to do seed saving. Like I just need water and like my tools and time and like sunlight. And like sugar bushing is like really incredible, but also like it's teaching me those like lines of even what we all face is like climate change. Like our harvesting is different now, where we can't follow those historical timelines of like, you hear stories of like, oh, when Meju Biju's in the sky, like that's when you're sugar bushing and that's when the ice is thawing. But we're seeing in Indigenous communities today that like, that's not tried and true. Like now I follow more of the weather network instead of like looking up at the sky and trying to look at the stars and like, look at the sugar bushing moon. I'm like looking at weather network. Like, when is it like actually time to like harvest these trees? Cause it's more of the temperature that's telling these times. And it's rough because it's like, sometimes we get 3 to 4 days that are like solid sugar bushing days. Sometimes we get 1 day that's a solid sugar bushing day. And then it's either too cold or too warm. And then it's also dealing with like, do we have snow still, or is it turning to mud now? Like, is it turning more to spring to even like bring all this water back to boil, has been tricky. And seeing those impacts of like climate change on like our traditional ways of life, and how we're not able to, like, those are now just talking about history of like when we could sugar bush, when we talk about those like teachings that we receive, which I think is really hard. But also like, yeah, we're really seeing those impacts of climate change. But like one thing that I find really cool is that our ways of life, like Indigenous ways of life, don't cause climate change. Like they actually are very like, they're very natural and they have to do with working with the land. Like we're working against like climate change when we do these traditional practices, which I think is really cool.
Awesome. Thank you, BZ. I feel like I went like on an entire journey with you there. Like, had a lot of like feelings come up and like a lot of hope and also like a lot of anger, I guess, as well, because, you know, how much like our people have been impacted by the actions of others while we're just trying to live our lives, you know, and like it gets frustrating, I think. And so, you know, I think that you touched a lot in terms of like how land and repatriation applies to you in terms of it being like a really like holistic, like it's not just the physical aspect, but it's also like language and culture and like relations with your elders and the generations that are coming too. So I wonder, I'm really interested actually. So mentioning your niche Manitowoc and Two-Spirit, and I think that it's an interesting question if you wanted to answer it, but I think that, you know, there's a lot that Two-Spirit people have to contribute to our communities in terms of reclaiming space. And I think that that is also a thing that is like, and it's too bad almost that we have to talk about it in a gendered way in terms of like rematriation or repatriation of land. But like land back as Niche Manitowoc and someone who like lives in such close proximity. Do you feel that they work together? Do you feel that, I'm just wondering your thoughts on that. I don't know if I'm clear or if I made a question actually.
I think you did. And that's like one of my favorite like questions like right now is like how people are like, how does your identity connect with all this? Because I find it all very connected. Like when I talk about language, when I talk about culture, when I talk about climate change, when I talk about like advocacy, I'm like, I feel like it's all connected. And very much my Two-Spirit identity is connected in this too. I feel like it's not linear like some people, and like the difficult thing is like, one of the things that really contribute to today is like residential schools really impacted our community, even like how we are even like accepting community members who are Two-Spirit. Like it was very like in the schools, like I can identify where the one my grandpa went to, it was so gendered there. Like the whole thing was so separated. Like as soon as you were brought there, you were put on the male or female side and like you grew up like that. Like there was no acceptance for like any kind of other thing. Like you could only be cisgendered and cis person like at those schools. And that was like, and also like gender roles are very pushed on us of like, especially in like those schools, because like, again, referencing the mesh hole, like from what it, like from teachings I got of like what happened there was like, the boys were taught how to do like farming, like to work on a farm, not even to run your own farm. It was like to work on a farm is what they were taught. And the girls were taught like to run a household, like just to like do like laundry, like simple cookings and stuff like that. But the things are very like in what we see today in society where they're like a woman like is like in a house and the man goes out and works. But like it was really interesting where like there was no more to it than that, especially like it really bugs me that they were like they were teaching them like how to be like workers on a farm and not to run their own. Like that was very strategic and like racism that they did there. So it's like we're still seeing that in community where like a lot of things are still gendered. Like when you go to ceremony, they're like there's a men and women side, and then when you go to culture camps and stuff like that, they still hold tried and true to those things where they're like men do fire keeping, men do the heavy lifting, and those things can feel really really limiting, especially when you don't fit into those boxes of like being able to even learn these types of things. Like it feels so limiting. Like fishing felt limiting, learning how to fire keep, I did a lot of that on my own. Like I learned really like well how to like I had to build that relationship to learn how to build like a really proper fire and to keep it going and to do different things, like keep heat in it for like a really good long time for even like boiling the sap. Like I had to learn all of that stuff by creating a relationship on my own rather than learning like very specific teachings from someone. And I think it's like, it's that importance of like creating space. But one thing that I really appreciated was when I went to the Lenape community and I asked, and I was like working with my uncle and I was learning like more specifically, like from Lenape community on like land stuff. And my uncle, he's actually my cousin, but he's old enough to be my uncle, so I call him uncle. he taught me about Lenape community before didn't have gender roles. Like he was like, it wasn't actually a thing. He was like, if you're a woman and you love to hunt, we wouldn't keep you out of the field because there was no point. Like we want good hunters out there. Like it didn't have to do anything with like your gender. If you wanted to be out there, then you were out there. And he was like, and then if you were a boy and you loved to garden or cook, he was like, we wouldn't have put like you anywhere but where you wanted to be, because that's where you're passionate and that's where you're going to do good work in the community. And so it was like learning that teaching that like gave me like confidence and like just being like, I can be anywhere and I can do anything because like, that's what I'm passionate about. And that's what I want to do. And what I want to do is relearn culture and relearn, language. And so those things like really gave me power, but it also has been really limiting where it's like finding those spaces that will allow non-binary people to be who they are and not like trying to gender you or anything. And I think Two-Spirit people have a really special place in these conversations about land back and about learning culture and like have teachings of culture and language.
Thanks, Beezy. I'm wondering if you can share your thoughts around land back. Even, I think sometimes we hear land back too in that, and it gets conflated with other meanings or topics. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or concerns around the practice of rematriation and land back, and maybe even what some of those differentiations might be. And specifically how settler institutions, colonial institutions might be taking that up, you know, might have already, you already, I think, see now, we see politicians taking up this concept or this word land back in really sort of worrisome ways, right? There was a conversation recently about land back essentially being, oh yeah, it's the same thing as comprehensive land claims, right? So I'm just wondering, yeah, what your thoughts are around the ways that these concepts might get taken up by colonial institutions and settler people.
Yeah, I find that really hard where like I can talk very specifically like on my community where like land back would be really, really important because like our area where we come from, like I said, there's like a bunch of issues with the refineries as well as having access to land where we like can do these things of like practicing like even harvesting or like ceremonies. Like we still practice ceremony within our community, but having access to those things of like a place to grow like an amazing like seed saving garden, even just lack of land of like that we have of like my reserves are really small, and we only have so much space for so many things, and even like hunting grounds and stuff like that, like land back for doing those kinds of things of like hunting, gathering, growing gardens for our seeds, I think would be like a really big game changer for a community like mine. And I'm like, and I think we can all think of like an Indigenous community that's being impacted by one of like these really big issues that we're bringing up in Canada, like things like environmental racism, where we're facing like heavy pollution, or we're facing like tar sands, or just like pipelines. Like we're looking at like what's happening with like the Wet'suwet'en people, where they're saying no to a pipeline. And like, it's so hard to see that in like even 2022, where they're still like really militarizing against those Indigenous people for just saying no, when my people didn't even have that option. And we're like, we're living with a pipeline and it's terrible. Like we wouldn't want that for anyone. And like, it's really hard to see that, like, that's the direction that Canada is going, rather than like seeing like a pipeline go to communities to even just bring clean water. Cause we're seeing like even a community as close to Toronto, like near Hamilton, like not having clean water, an Indigenous community, and that's near a metropolis. And then there's like many communities like up north, there's northern communities that even need ways to get like fresh food and stuff. Like they can sometimes go for a time without like fresh vegetables. And we're seeing like those like lack of like investment or help for Indigenous communities, and as simple as asking for land back, like it's not happening within Canada. But what we are seeing is militarization against Indigenous people, and like funding going into that, which I think is crazy. And then like, yeah, how much it would even like assist in like a small community like mine. And even just like reclamation of like land that we lost, because like a lot of shady land deals happened, and deforestation and alterations of the land happen where I come from, where we used to have like swamps, but now we don't anymore. And like, I've even heard of, we used to have moose, and I was like, that's crazy. Like I would never picture a moose in Amjadong, not even a bear. Like we have raccoons and deers and possums, but like nothing like that big. but I think it like, it's a really important topic. And I think it leads into a lot of like these like greater issues, that we see within Canada, within like environmental racism, and like also just like really reflecting on like what Canada is actually doing, which is, like I said, like heavily militarizing against Indigenous people, putting a lot of money and funds into that rather than like land back or like clean drinking water or better like food systems for up north.
Thanks, Bees. I think I'm really reflecting a lot on what you're saying, I think, because it impacts us, I think, in like a way that when I'm sitting here and I'm listening to you talk, it's almost like I'm feeling like generations, like not just the generations behind me or like the generations that I come from, but like I feel a mixture of like sadness and hope, right? And I think that that contains, like that being contained in our bodies, reminds me a lot of like, you know, the land as a body, and the land maybe also feeling sadness and hope too. And, you know, it feels like a little bit overwhelming, I think, a lot of times. And I guess one of my questions is like, how do you think, you know, we talk about like theory a lot, and what land back could look like. And I guess I wanted to frame the question in the context of like, in one of my language classes, my language teacher, I asked him, I was like, how do you say land back in our language? And he's like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, you know how everyone's talking about land back? I was like, how do you say it? And then he's like, he really thought for a while, and he's like, I don't think that I could translate it in the context that you're telling me, because the land isn't something that we have or give away or get back. Like the land is its own entity, like, you know, so you were talking a lot about like how our culture and like our ways of living inform your current reality. And I just wonder if that sparks anything in you, or if you have anything to say about my non-question again.
And like, it reminds me like how, what you said, what your elder does, and like that, like there was such a confusion, like, and that's why like shady land deals happened, or like the like taking over of like spaces happened in like early colonization, because like there was no even space in our language like to be like, you like, that is your land and that is mine kind of thing. Like it's so like, I love our language for so many reasons, and that's one of them, is that like it's not viewed as like property. And I'm like, that's really cool. And yeah, I'm like, yeah, it makes sense that there's no way to say like land back. And I think it says it enough in English, because that's the language that they understand. But for like how to put it into practice, I think it's really interesting where like now in my life right now, I moved up to the area of where like my partner's from, which is like, we live in Tiny right now, but like their like area that like their people had been living for a bit is like more of like a Métis settlement in Severn, like Port Severn. And so I'm living up here, and it was really like, I came up here to learn language in a college sense, but also just to like focus time on learning an Anishinaabemowin, and then having some kind of thing behind me to be like, no matter what in life, I can teach the language. So I got my, I came up here for my college degree in Anishinaabemowin, and I graduated. But then like I met someone up here, so I stayed up here. And I've always wanted kind of like a little bit of that like break from Amjong. I love Amjong a lot, but I wanted to experience what it like lived, what it was like living rurally too. But one of the things was, when I first moved out here, I had no like connection to ceremony, I had no connection to Two-Spirit community. I had barely any connection to land up here, because I was like, I know it's north and I know I can just walk into the bush somewhere here, but like I don't have any connection. Like I don't know if I'd be walking on someone's like farm or anything. I was like, I guess I can Google like forests around here. So like finding those like connections were like really hard, and like but I found like connections through like through, what is it called, like through friends and like farms. Like I did, like I learned a lot about seed saving up here, which is something I really wanted to learn about and practice. And this is where I got gifted up here, was my uncle gave me seeds to Lenape squash and corn and beans. And so I was so, so grateful, and I was like so excited, but I was like, but of course this is when I move away from like my homeland and I have no soil to grow on. Like I lived in a very small area, and like in a very small apartment. I was like, I don't even have a windowsill to grow these. Like, I don't have a windowsill to grow corn. Like, it's not big enough. So, I made connections through my partner to work with their garden, and that was some of the like best times of like learning about a garden, was like, because it was with my partner, it was like very Two-Spirit oriented kind of thing. So there was a lot of Two-Spirit community around that we were like learning all together from. And like, there was like someone even that like I met up here through them that like came from a farmer family. So it was cool hearing like those like teachings of like from a farmer family of like how to cultivate like a garden and all that kind of stuff, and like stuff behind the garden and how to really help the corn. And like they had already been practicing it for a bit. So learning from them too about how to like properly grow this corn, and like near where a bunch of like other GMO corn was growing. So like how to like properly save that. But it was through like a indigenous farm up here that like was through someone's like organization. So I was growing on like already an indigenous farm, so they didn't care like when I just pulled up in my really crappy little car and like early in the morning I would hop out and like be watering my garden. Like they were so chill and so nice. And even now having the connection up here of like, I have another really queer, awesome friend that owns land up here. And like, it was really cool to like have like that access to, like, I would just drive to their farm and walk down to their creek and hang out by their creek. And they give me like access to, like, if I want garden space out there, they've given us access to, for hunter, for trapping. So we've actually done trapping on their land, and it was like really cool to go visit that trap line every once in a while. And I saw a vole for the first time in my life because of that trap line. He was like hanging out in the box, like eating stuff. And it scared me because I was like, oh, something's in the box. I was like, I think we got something. And I look in there and it's a little blind vole like wandering around in the back of it. And I was like, cool, I've never seen one of those. So I was like, yeah, it was like really cool how access to land like came around when I really was like needing it. I was like, oh, I'm in such a new place and I know nothing about living up north. I was like, I don't know if a bear's just gonna walk out of nowhere. Like, I've never been up north really. So to get like interested like with that landscape. And then my partner lived like at Back's a sugar bush. And so doing sugar bushing up here was so different than down south. And then all these accesses to lands, like I got to really practice and experience more on my own being up here. And it was really, really, really cool. But I found like, yeah, connections to like, even though like I didn't have those like accesses at the time, like I really actually got help from like farm people and like them even like allowing to use like their like equipment. Like they would use a tractor to turn the land first, and then I could do all the stuff to build a garden. I was like, even that was super helpful. And so I was like, that's like a really cool, like interesting way of like how like land back has happened for me, even like the connection to farmland, and like how I think like some ways it can be implemented.
That's really great. And that's the kinds of conversations that we've been having at RARE about what might land back or land sharing look like in practice, in ways where folks are actually building trusting relationships and actually able to do that work in a good way. So you sort of in that sense answered my question, but if you had anything to add about, you've talked a lot about, to me, you talked a lot about Indigenous food sovereignty and land sovereignty and what relationships that might have to the responsibilities that settler folks and non-Indigenous folks have, especially landowning folks, have to building these relationships and to our treaty relationships, right? To the many, many, many broken treaty promises that we ought to be mending. So I'm just wondering, to close things up, if you have any final thoughts on how that looks in practice, or what folks could take away when listening to this.
Yeah, I don't know what folks can take away listening to this. I feel like I learned how to talk about stuff through elders, and like their way of talking is like not linear. Like they're not like a high school professor trying to teach you how to do something. Like they're usually like tell you a bunch of stories and then they're kind of leave it at that, and then it's kind of mic drop and you take what you can from the conversation. And so I very much took on that type of way of talking, and like I found it works. So take what you can from this, like even if it was like an emotion from a story or something. But I think, I don't know, like I'm seeing like in ways in my own life where like I got seeds from my uncle kind of thing, and I have him to thank for my first Lenape seeds, and those are very special and I hold on to them. But also I got seeds from someone who got them from a Quaker community in the US that had been seed saving like those Lenape seeds for generations. When, and like there's like a really cool story of one bean I have that was carried by a Lenape woman who was like really like, she has a really cute story, and I can't tell it like all of it right now because it's quite long. But she held on to these beans and she gave them off to the Quaker community, and they kept growing them so that they kept going and stayed a strong seed. And now I have one of those beans, and like even seeing like the giving back of like seeds is really cool. Of like, I got those seeds, like I got a good stock of those seeds because of that, like that person that had those seeds from the Quakers, as well as like, I got corn from connections to like Indigenous community that like, the person wasn't Lenape that had like a big stock of the corn that I got. And they gave it to me, because they knew I was like, I'm like a new like learner person, but I'm still like a Lenape person trying to learn back and how to grow like these seeds and have a good year with these seeds. But they still gave me all their corn seeds, and I was like, that's so nice. So like, I have like a good seed stock now to try and make a better seed stock for my community. And I think like one of the cool things that like I found was that, yeah, people gave me like garden space to do that kind of stuff. And I live in like a farmhouse where there's access to land for like hide tanning. Like I have like a full space where I can leave like my frames up. I have a small garden here. I have a sugar bush here, but access to like those farmlands, and like there's old sugar bush roads back behind the house that I'm able to use too. And having access to even like farmers in my area, like I mentioned, my friend up here, gives me even bigger access to land if I need it, even if it's like for, like I've asked them, like if it would even be chill if I had like a fundraiser event, and they were like, yeah. I was like, even just like that access, like, and that open communication I have with them, that like, they're like a really good friend, but also like, I have like that access of like, I even like can practice like my aim for like shooting, like for deer season. Like I went back there and practiced a bit too. And like, we talked about where it would be good, because like in farm fields, like you want to be able to shoot where it's not like going to go to someone else's property. So like, I figured out areas that I can do like gun range practice for hunting season. I found a place that I can garden there. Like, we're always welcome to do trapping there. Like, it's really cool to be able to have that kind of access and like open communication. And I think that is something that could, like, we could see in like in many different ways of like community, like whether that's Indigenous or even just Two-Spirit genderqueer community, of creating those connections and like those groups. Like we have like the Two-Spirit hide camp that is like very much like committed to learning back hide tanning, but with Two-Spirit community, and that like special connection of like, because there's so much that comes with like hide tanning. There's like fire keeping that you have to do, like there's a role for everyone, and anyone can hide tan. And I always joke, like when I'm teaching about hide tanning, I'm like, if I can teach you to hide tan, then you can like remember my pronouns. Like, if I can teach you how to tan a hide, then you can definitely remember my pronouns. Like, that's one of my biggest things about teaching, where I'm like, if it's within Two-Spirit community or not. Like, it's very important to me. But yeah, I think like those kind of like connections of like creating community and like finding these places of like that we can do that, or even like we've even with the hide camp, we were able to use Springwater Park, which is run by Beausoleil First Nation, and they like offered the space to us, and they had like water for us to use, and like we were able to set up our teepees and our lodges and all those things for the hide tanning and camp, and it was like really amazing, like those kind of connections that can be made of like space and land and like resources that are available on those lands that like community can create.
Thank you so much, BZ. Thank you for sharing your story and also the work that you're doing. That sounds really amazing. And I can't wait to hear more as you move through this and as you start to just build that knowledge and build that experience. So thanks so much for sharing.
I really want to thank BZ for taking the time to talk with us today. It's always so great to connect with you and learn about your work and your experiences. I also want to thank my fellow collaborators and colleagues and friends, Taryn Giacomini, Lauren Kepkowitz, Danielle Boissonneau, Adrienne Lickers-Xavier, and Ayla Fenton. And thank you to all of our research assistants, both past and present. Thank you to Stephanie Morningstar, Sonia Hill, Jessica Ross, and to Jaron Richard for your wonderful tech support. We also want to thank the National Farmers Union Indigenous Solidarity Working Group for your ongoing collaboration and support, as well for the financial support from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. Okay, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening.